One of my favorite memories from school is the morning that my mom forced me and my sister to leave for school late so we could watch the rest of an old movie on TV. She thought that kind of education was more worthwhile than whatever we'd learn in the first hour of school. Sarah Grossman also grew up with a unique family dynamic that shaped the way she talks to her parents and her brothers even now.
At a certain point, being good at sports stopped mattering in my family. Being tough was worth nothing. If it hurt, you were supposed to listen to your body, which made our coaches hate us, even when we were the best players on the team. Apparently, mind over matter existed, but took an opposite effect when it came to us. We didn't preach it like those guys in the movies who broke all their fingers on both their hands and still managed to sink the winning shot with the torn ACL. It was a mantra that allowed us to fall short of what could have been our achievements almost every single game or practice that we weren't feeling 100%. Add a simple gene of paranoia to the mix, and you can imagine we weren't feeling 100% very often. From an early age, we all understood we were only granted one body and that we better not overwork it because it was going to have to last us a pretty long time. We'd always had the musical side. That began when I was 6 years old and when my three older brothers, David, Jonathan, and Zach, were 8, 10, and 11, respectively. Jonathan started teaching himself rock piano then, branching out from classical music and sounding out chords from popular songs on the radio. It was then that he began encouraging me to sing as well. Every single night without fail, Jonathan's hands hit the piano keys, David grabbed the drum set, Zach took guitar, and I took the microphone. The Beatles were the first writers of our evenings. By the time I was in fifth grade, it was Jonathan who composed our after-dinner bonding. This is a clip from a song, Diamond in the Rough, that he wrote when he was in ninth grade. We sing together on the track. One of the first lessons from my dad was to never go to sleep mad. He provided little explanation, just told me it was bad for me. In my young brain, I understood it in a tangible, physical sense, like going to sleep angry might result in waking with a fever. It is a lesson I learn over and over again, the difference between waking up with a thought lodged in your ribcage versus waking up to clean breath. I have learned that I was right all along, that it is physical. It's the conversations that are hard to have that end up lodged there. The conversations that indict the person on the receiving end until that feeling evaporates. With my brothers, there is no such thing. We will never go to sleep until we are all on the same page, signatures on that line with the X at the bottom, dated, all T's crossed. Jonathan and I reached that point first, that point at which we felt we could say anything to each other and so said everything to each other. When we each were sophomores, I in high school, he in college, Jonathan said to me, "If you died right now, it would be okay. It would be the least okay in terms of loss," he had said, "but the most okay in terms of fulfillment." There was no outstanding balance with us, nothing that we didn't understand about each other, no explanations that we owed. If we never could see each other again, there was nothing we felt we'd missed out on. It's the stuff that's missing that gets lodged in your lungs when you wake up after going to sleep raw. Sometimes there's no time to find it before bedtime. Sometimes what's missing can't be found by talking to other people. At least not in time for brushing your teeth and tucking yourself in. I identify the time that we lost sports with the time that we began to talk. It seemed our musings on the rigidity within sports and hierarchy within the team made us all cry bullshit. We hated the favoritism and tough love and the psychology of motivation. Should a coach challenge his player or nurture her, compliment her or criticize her? Hated the mind games. We were interested in looking towards a higher level of sensitivity when it came to people dealing with people. My dad, who wavered between a psychology and philosophy major in college, constantly insulted the coaches who threw chairs, felt like teams would do better if the coaches just connected with the kids. "Can't they see what these kids need?" he'd say. I skipped a basketball season to be in a play. Neither of my parents ever believed in punishment. They treated it like it was an ideology they refused to buy into. Even after endless teasing and pranks by my youngest older brother, David, no matter how many times I asked that he be locked in a room or his dessert be taken away, the closest we ever got was a question. When are you going to stop bothering your sister? I asked that he be thrown out the window. They told me I had a great sense of humor. No, they'd respond. One day, they believed we would even grow to be friends. I have to say at this point that they were right. My brothers and I came to be close because we weren't allowed not to be. I never thought it was weird that I sat in on their playdates and played Lincoln Logs alongside whoever came over that day. It was kind of like the condition under which one of the Grossman kids would continue to be friends with someone if he or she got along with the rest of us. I didn't realize that it was abnormal that at a certain point we opted for summer evenings on our own rather than inviting the friends over. We communicated by ourselves at a certain level that only few reached. Even now, we say we won't get married until we have all the siblings' approval. Family vacations would be terrifying with someone even one of us didn't like. Even more terrifying would be not to have family vacations because someone one of us didn't like. We were always questioning people. Not like putting them on the witness stand, but kind of like asking them to take a load off on a friendly, warm, instead of hot, hot seat. I remember being in third grade and asking one of Zach's friends, one of the cutest boys in his eighth grade class, about his instant message conversation with one of Jonathan's friends, the prettiest girl in Jonathan's seventh grade class. I also remember his surprise at the fact that Jonathan had relayed information to me that had nothing to do with me at all. I was always asking the older kids surprising questions, and was always surprised that they consistently answered. By the time I was a freshman in high school, friends would come over after parties so they could have kitchen time with David and me, something we'd do every night before bed, whether or not a friend was present, whether or not it was a weekend. There, we discussed the whole night over pita chips and cream cheese. Zach never followed his three younger siblings in this art of finding out everything there was to know about a person, the art of talking, of feeling connected. His loyalty never quite seemed to be ours. He continued to be captivated by the rah-rah aspect of sports, the family of a team, the leadership he could exhibit. We felt like the familial aspect of his basketball team was conditional, based on performance, and that he felt such a strong feeling of duty and obligation. He never found the same love of shooting the breeze and laughing till the wee hours. We thought the seriousness with which he took sports was funny, the seriousness with which he took himself during sports even more humorous.
He can agree when they say, lucky guy, no doubt about it.
People can say hurtful things that can't be retracted, and even if they're apologized for, will never do much more than tarnish, fade, fog up, be piled on top of. On one summer night in high school, I sat and listened while my family held a meeting on my ability to think. It had always been noted that Jonathan and I sided together for any family argument or decision. As I was the younger of the two, I apparently was always the follower of him, definitely not an equal leader. They said that at a certain point, if I continued only to agree with him, that I wouldn't have my own brain. Now, I reflect that I wasn't just blindly agreeing with him. I just trusted his decisions more than the rest of the families. Then, I sat there, playing with my cell phone, trying to keep from showing weakness. At a certain point, I left, allowing them to continue to discuss my brain. I eavesdropped from the hallway, listened to my mom walk into the conversation from her room. This talking thing, she said, you guys can talk things out all you want, but this won't help her. This is only going to do harm. I agreed. I still agree. It was a conversation abusing the power of talk. Multiple people on one side, ganging up on one, each person gaining a point for a good argument, nothing constructive about it. Sharing their beliefs with me wasn't helpful, even if they were true. It was a part of honesty that just wasn't good.
Sarah Grossman is a sophomore at Stanford. She and her brother Jonathan recorded the music for this piece.